You don't have to be a totally unique rare bird original right now. You can just literally start emulating the things that turn you on, relax and know what inspires you and copy it. And I think that, or emulate it, or model yourself after. I still do that today.
Something I learned this week: if you make a contact in your iPhone of all the crazy cuss words and strange words that you say, from FOMO to fucking instead of ducking, okay, then your phone will stop trying to autocorrect it. Because if it's in a contact, it doesn't. It assumes that you know what you're talking about. So you can make a contact with a name that's 40 words as the name of the contact. Game changing. Thank you, Sophia Bush, for that. Not that you asked, but I'm completely healed of my vaccine weakness. So I said at the end of last week's episode that I got the pneumonia vaccine and the flu vaccine at once, and it knocked me on my ass. I was truly in bed for 4 days, which, some say that being sick is claustrophobic because you can't do what you gotta do. For me, being sick, to be honest, is a little bit of a vacation. I'm not talking about hospitalized sick, but like just sick in bed, because you can really say no to things. You really like, and your like FOMO or desire to say yes and sense of social scarcity, I don't know what that is, I have that, is gone because I'm so weak. I'm like, I literally can't do anything. This is truly me time. So of course I watched all of Squid Game, obsessed. Loved it. I cried. I laughed. I covered my eyes. If you can handle unmitigated gore and super hot Korean cops, you will probably like that show. I mean, you've probably already watched it. It's the number one show in the world. But anyway, that's the update on me. Okay, this is this week's episode. Oh, hello, everyone. Welcome back to Question the Self. It's your host, Jedediah Jenkins. On this show, we have guests that respond to your questions and mine, and we always pick a topic. Today's topic is career. Again, we did that with John Chu. I just love the questions and the journey around what am I supposed to do with my life, my career, spend my time doing and making. For me, that was just such a formative, motivating, mind-consuming question in my 20s that I think it's just really helpful to talk about. My guest today is my friend Daniel Roseberry. He's creative director at the fashion brand Schiaparelli. You might have seen their work on Beyoncé, on Adele, on Lady Gaga at the inauguration, on Lorde on the cover of Vogue, that lung necklace on one of those Hadids. What I'm saying is, his stuff is everywhere. He has taken over and is the most exciting thing in fashion right now. And to me, if you think about it, haute couture fashion is this like really tip of the spear, esoteric touch point in art that trickles down and affects fashion and clothing and ideas and celebrity all the way down into the public consumption. So it's really interesting to talk to someone in such a rarefied job who designs the most elaborate, wild costume clothes for Cardi B and wows the world, and he's drawing it in his hands, and these dreams come true. And there's only a handful of haute couture houses. You have to be invited. There's not very many, and he's head of one. And to be honest, it doesn't surprise me. There's something, there's a star quality about him, there's a way he sees the world, and a bigness and a bravado in his attempts, his artistic attempts. And it works. He hits it out of the park every time. I'm going to post a bunch of images of my favorite of his designs on my Instagram so you can go look at it because it is unbelievable. I've known him for over 10 years, and he's been working at Schiaparelli just a few years. And in that time, he has made Schiaparelli almost a household name, which people knew about it. It's a historic brand, but he brought it such fire and modern relevance. It's really, it's just really cool to see. So This conversation was so good, we did it twice. I interviewed Daniel. He texted me after. He's like, I have so much more to say and I have questions I want to ask you. So I was like, let's do a double whammy. We recorded a second conversation. That was so good. I could have put them together in like a 2.5 hour episode, but sometimes that's overwhelming. You see that, you're like, I'm not listening to all that. But it, for me, I actually love seeing a long episode because sometimes I'm in the car and I'm like, ooh, 2 hours. I want to listen to that. So this one is just so good. I divided it into 2 1-hour episodes. In episode one, we talk about how to find your career path, how to find the bravery and what steps to take a big leap and try something new, how to learn through negative reinforcement, aka by trying things and seeing what doesn't work that actually guides you towards what works, why Daniel reads like every review, which many people say don't do. He has really articulated reasons why he does, how you balance art and purity of art with commerce and with selling art. Sometimes those things are a real conflict, but of course Daniel has a strong opinion about that. And why it's nice to have vocationally diverse friends, why it's nice to have friends who don't all do the same things as you. And also, by the way, just to lure you into episode two, in episode two we talk about, are you living your dream or someone else's and how to tell the difference, how to overcome imposter syndrome, how to find a mentor, like how do you go from the intern to like running the show? Like how? Other like really in-depth inside fashion things. Like, did you know brands pay stars to wear their clothes to the Oscars? Like the stars are making tons of money and it's very cool to see the behind the scenes of all that world. Also, I ask him specifically in episode two, what is it like to dress Gaga, Beyonce, people like Adele? Like, what is that? Where? How does that call come in? Are you meeting with them? Are you measuring their bodies? Like, wow, that is so cool. And things like, what's the difference between a hard worker and a star? Because there has to be, everyone's working hard that's really doing big things. So what makes a star? Okay. Episode one first. I love this conversation. This is part one of Daniel Roseberry on career.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Jed.
Thanks for joining me on the show.
Good to see you again.
I feel like you and I differ on this, but I am not terribly ambitious when it comes to career because as an Enneagram 7, I just want to have fun. Like I exist on this planet to have fun,
right,
and to like be amazed and scream at the ocean and waves and run around and love people. And yes, I love writing books and I definitely believe that writing, communicating ideas is my purpose and my passion. Or as Oprah says, what is it that you were meant to bring? Mm-hmm. I feel like a certain level of like thinking, a type of thinking and seeing is what I was meant to bring, at least in this stage of my life. But like thinking about work, I don't really think about it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, are you an Enneagram 3? Like, how do you think about work in terms of you just want to do it all the time? I feel like, or you're trying to achieve great things where I'm not.
But actually are. So you're actually winning here because it's, yeah, I'm a 3-4. So I'm definitely a full-time 3 with a hard 4 for me. And I think a lot about my 20s. My 20s were a lot about, you know, working crazy hours during the week, you know, when I was working at Thom Browne. You knew me during this time. And my friends on the weekends, I especially felt this around summertime, but really it was all the time. My friends would go to the beach and everything, and I just couldn't help myself from going in because I've always felt like it's only going to be what I make of it, you know? And
wow.
I feel like that now. I think that I have one of my big fears and insecurities in life is also one of my deep motivators, which is that I would not be living the life the grandness and the fullness of the life that I've always fantasized about, you know? And I think that a lot of my drive for work is not even like success or, because I know none of that stuff is real, but it's just, I feel like I'm just chasing that, that fullest expression and, that it's, there's like a restlessness, I think, that I'm constantly kind of chasing after.
Have you distilled when you say through your vocation, you are living your purpose? Have you always known the words to describe what that purpose is? Or has that been a journey to find? Like when you were at Tom Brown, did you know you were doing that, or you were still reaching for a different, ethereal fantasy?
When I was in therapy in my 20s, and it was around the time when I was kind of coming out to my family and everything. And, my therapist said to me, he was really great. I saw him for like 2.5 years. He was really great. And he said, you know, Daniel, I reserve the right to change my mind here, but I'm pretty sure that your key purpose is the bringer of good news. Like that is what motivates you. That's what activates you and turns you on. And it made me think of Daniel from the Bible, who I'm named after whom I'm named. And he was the interpreter of dreams. And I think that that's also like, I've always kind of felt like in touch with what people wanted to see or tried to anticipate what people wanted to see. And fashion became a medium by which to kind of create images, basically, you know. And I was doing an interview this morning with Vogue Poland, I think, or some like, you know, whatever, international Vogue. And I was just kind of confessing. I was like, you know, I'm not a dressmaker. I'm not obsessed with clothes. I'm not a fashion historian, blah, blah, blah. But I do love making images. I love putting imagery out there. And fashion is also normally, in normal times, it's an intersection where music and art and fashion and also the communal part of creation is all kind of colliding in this orgasmic event 4 times a year. So it's also very instant gratification. You know, I don't think I could ever be like what you do. Writing is also for me kind of parallel to being like an architect or something, where you build something for such a long period of time and then it takes another year to get it put out there in the world. And I just like, that's equivalent to painting to me, where you let the paint dry and you go over it again and you return to it, blah, blah. For me, it's like, I like drawing. I like instant gratification. I like the rapid kind of seeing things come out soon, knowing how to respond to them, and then changing it up like 3 months later.
I was going to say, well, why aren't you a painter? Why aren't you in another form of art? Like, why did it lend towards fashion? And would you say it's because fashion is something that you can make and see and have much faster?
Yeah. And there's something very instant about it. You know, you can pick up fabric and in 2 seconds, you can have something that represents an itch that you need to scratch. And I don't know, there's a cultural resonance with fashion too, where it's reflecting our world. And I also, the connection between fashion and music has always been a huge motivator. I always think in like music videos, album covers, like I want my lookbooks to look like stills from music videos in a weird way.
I haven't thought about the fact that fashion, similar to music, is an art form that gets grafted on and plays with other art. So it's incorporated into other art, where a painting isn't in the same way.
And I don't know if you've ever tried, I mean, you're an artist too, like you're a drawer, right? I've never seen anything.
Yeah, I like to draw, that's it, but I really like it.
But you know, my friend Teva, she paints for 4 hours a day. She wakes up and she has to paint. And I never felt like that about anything except for fashion.
What would you say to someone who wakes up and doesn't have to do anything? Like they don't actually feel like any pull in any direction, but they wish they did.
I would say that most creative acts, and I actually like, I take that back. I don't wake up with this burning desire to create fashion. I don't. Most, and whenever people say, you know, I paint like Teva, I paint because I have to, or we have this like tortured artist thing in our mind. Mm-hmm. That was never me. I feel like most creative acts of expression are choices. So it's really just a choice to get up and do it. And I think a lot of it is about finishing too. You know, I was talking with Hanya and we were saying, you know, like, you don't have to be the most talented. You don't have to be the most intelligent, but most of the time you just have to finish, because a lot of people starting and getting through can be easy, but actually finishing well, I think, says a lot.
Remind listeners who Hanya is.
Hanya Yanagihara is the one of my best friends. She's the editor-in-chief of New York Times Style Magazine, T Magazine, and she's the writer, author of A Little Life. And by the time this episode, our episode comes out, her next book will have been announced. I think it's being announced tomorrow.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an exclusive that will be after the fact. So is it an even exclusive? Okay. Here's a question. And I have an answer to this as well. How are you nourished by having very close relationships with creatives who are in a different field?
I know you feel the same way. Like, relationships are the principal source of nourishment for me, next to nature, probably. You know, I think that surrounding yourself with artists who work in different mediums is so important. I don't do that enough, to be honest. I really don't. I think that musicians are different. Sorry, I keep burping.
Bubbles. Those are the small bubbles too. When I drink Topo Chico, I'm like truly a dragon from Game of Thrones.
But yeah, I think that for me, it's like, for me, like the kind of collaborations I'd like to do would be with lots of non-visual artists. I the last person I want to talk to about creativity is another fashion designer. So I've always been really turned on by people who are not really in fashion. And it's just been more relieving for me. How would you answer that question?
Well, I fell into it in a way, living in Los Angeles / Nashville, which is I have friends in the creative world that are all doing different things than I am. And so not only does that cross-pollinate in the sense where you see the world as an opportunity to tell stories, whether it's acting, singing, screenwriting, photography, videography, we see the world with kind of a similar lens, but what I've found to be so lovely is that there's no competition. I feel none, mm-hmm. because we're not chasing the same grant. We're not chasing the same book deal. We're not chasing the same job. And so it's pure celebration. And I would like to think that we are all so elevated that there wouldn't be, even if we were all the same. But I just don't think I think I've benefited from the accident of having a very creative, so in one way, it's not that diverse, but multidisciplinary friend group where it is pure, like one friend is writing pop songs and it hits number one, or they get nominated for an award and we're screaming. Because like, not only are we proud, but he didn't steal that nomination from me. I couldn't do that.
Totally. And totally. Yeah.
You know, I picture, this is total ignorance, but like, if you work at a Wall Street firm and all your friends work at the firm with you, it's like one of you is getting the bonus and the others aren't. And that's a tension in the air, I would think. Mm-hmm. I have like very few book writer friends, and I would like to have more, I think. But
would you?
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, the thing about being a memoirist too is like, well, nobody has my life. So I don't feel like, in your line of work, someone could steal your idea. There's a whole Instagram account based on that, you know, that tracks fashion ripping each other off. Right. You can't rip off my life or the way that I see it's more, much harder. So I actually have no, I feel very rarefied in that way, in a good way.
Right. And on the flip side, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is this quote by a famous Japanese designer, Yoji Yamamoto. And he said, copy what you love, copy, copy, copy. And at the end of the, no, copy what inspires you, copy, copy, copy. And at the end of the copy, you will find yourself. And I think that that is so genius, because I wish I had heard that quote in college, because it was like, you don't have to be a totally unique rare bird original right now. You know, you can just literally start emulating the things that turn you on, which I think is really valuable.
Yes. And it's affirming. It's like, you don't have to come out the gates Mozart.
Play
your favorite songs until your fingers know exactly what they're doing and they have feelings of their own.
If you're even asking the question of originality, you're not Mozart. Like, he wasn't even asking himself that stuff. So I feel like if you're even having that kind of conversation with yourself, relax and know what inspires you and copy it, you know, and I think that, or emulate it, or, you know, model yourself after. I still do that today.
I remember there's a quote from C.S. Lewis where, of course, I won't say it right, but the gist was, whenever you're at a party and someone is trying to be funny, it makes your skin crawl. You can feel it. And he goes, 9 out of 10 times when someone is trying to be original, they aren't. It's cringeworthy. Mm. Whereas mm-hmm. if someone is truly authentically themselves to their own perspective, then they're original without ever having intended to be. And I thought that 100%. Was so cool as well. But I love the invitation to copy, because that's how you... Also, collecting what you love builds your taste, builds your refinement, and you studying what you love and why you love it. All of a sudden, you collect all the things you love and you look across and you might see a pattern of a certain aesthetic, a certain flavor.
Totally. And as you said, like, no one has my brain. So even if I'm drawing Gautier's boob tube, like, you know, bullet bras, they're going to look slightly different when I do it. And also, you know, other designers have done that all the way back to the 30s, 20s, whatever. So it's really, as you said, it's like such a relief, you know, and so empowering.
Do you feel, to do that. Also, speaking of like the touch of originality, I'll turn in like a draft of a book or a chapter, and my editor will edit some and send it back to me. And sometimes I try to read it without all the markings so that I can't see the bloodbath.
Right.
Because if he cut out something major and I didn't notice, then it shouldn't have been there in the first place. So that's what I like. But sometimes he will clean up a few sentences and make them one, and he will insert one word, one adjective, one noun. I will immediately say, I would never say that. I wouldn't say that I have any idiosyncratic special way of talking. I'm just speaking English the way I was trained. Yeah. And yet even I can recognize if someone changes my sentence the slightest bit, I'm like, I would never say it like that.
Completely. I feel the exact same way. And I feel like emotionally who I am and also creatively has been so defined by things coming in and being like, that's not me. That's not me. I don't like that. Like, you know, someone could treat you a certain way and you're like, what just happened is so not a part of my life going forward.
Yeah.
So it's almost learning who you are through negative reinforcement in a weird way, you know,
putting yourself in different situations and feeling how you react and then identifying, moving in the direction of what feels right and moving away from what feels wrong.
Totally. Totally.
It is so true. Like, even if you're decorating your bedroom, you start moving furniture around and you stand back and you go, it's not right. Something. And then you go, let me turn this like this. Let me put the plant over here. Let me put a book. And then you're like, oh, there it is. It's almost like you're uncovering a mystery.
Totally. And it's just, we always think that we're going to have all these positive examples to show us the way. But a lot of the time it's some sometimes the negative examples that really crystallize things, you know?
Wow. So you've said to me before, dreams are expensive. What do you mean when you say that?
So I was telling you about a quote that actually my boyfriend used. And that quote, which he's said multiple, many times, was really, I mean, it's something that has come to define or sort of explain the way that the world that I'm living over the past 2 years. And since I started working, and I think that, you know, on the surface level, I think it speaks a lot to the sacrifice that something like what's happening to me right now is costing, which is really just moving to another country, moving to a country where I don't know anybody, and, you know, sacrificing a lot of the social and communal elements that made my life really rich back home. But then on a more like interior aspect, I think as a student and in my 20s when I was working at Thom Browne as a number two, I thought I would understand. I thought I could imagine what it would feel like to be front of house, to be the one taking the bow. You know, there were so many times where Thom would get out there and take the bow, and I would try, and I thought I could imagine what that would be like to be rushed from reporters at the end and blah, blah, blah. But in reality, I had no idea. And when I started, it was like, I want to be as open and as vulnerable and as available as possible. And I kept giving little pieces away. And what I realized is that everyone will willingly take those pieces, and then they will forget about them. And the pieces will be gone for me, but it will change who I am. It's not going to change who they are. And so I think that's like the thing I've been feeling a lot more, is how do I stay fully present and available, but also have boundaries so that.
What does giving away a piece you can't get back mean?
I guess I don't know actually with your book. If you, and I think we're probably very different in this way, but from the first book, you opened your journal, basically, like your diary became everyone's diary. And I think that there is a real beauty to that, but also at the end of the day, sometimes it feels like you've just extended yourself too much or given something away that maybe somebody didn't earn the right to, or do you know what I mean? So I don't know. Did you feel like that, or was it not like that for you?
Well, I will say, I remember Glennon Doyle saying, write from your scars, not your wounds. And, you know, we see people writing from their wounds on Twitter and Facebook all the time. They're going through it and I would say oversharing in a place of looking for validation from people they barely know. Even though, like, I wouldn't say I have landed on some unifying theory of everything, I definitely have come a long way in my spiritual deconstruction, on my understanding of self, on my understanding of family, my role in the world. And so even though I exposed my journal and myself and my heart in that book, I wouldn't say people didn't earn it, because that's just not the way I frame it. It's mm-hmm. I earned this level mm-hmm. of self-understanding, and I wish I had seen any roadmap like this before. So I'm going to give this away now. Well, for $26, I'm going to give it away. And then maybe that will help someone on their own journey. But I've lived this now. I'm done with this. Y'all can have it. I'm going to go on and live this next chapter. And so mm-hmm. I think because I lived in fear of my wholeness as a person for so long, like radical openness is like a revolution to me, a rebellion against the way I felt of, what if people found out this about you? All your whole world would come crashing down. So to have strangers know virtually everything about me, it feels like true liberty to me.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that Yeah, I get that, and I feel that too. I think that, and I get really turned on by even the opportunity to be radically open and honest and available to people in ways that probably other people in my job role or whatever would not normally be. But I think that there's something potentially uniquely problematic about the industry in which I'm working, which is very much like we'll chew you up and spit you out and we'll forget your name. You know what I mean? Like you really are only as good as your last collection here. So I think that that's what I'm more grappling with, you know, and it's kind of like how do you stay like innocent and v naive and at the same time have wisdom about the way that this industry works, you know, and beat the system. So
Is there like a North Star in your mind in terms of what does it look like to grow into this business? You're a young man, you know, you're not even close to 40. So it's like you have a long way to go, is what I'm saying. So like to be worried that you're not the top of mind every season. Oh, maybe that's just the life you chose, you know. Maybe that's if you're a farmer, you better make sure that the crops grow every year or you're dead. So I don't know, like how do you, is that too intense or heavy to think about? Or, and you just take one bite at a time, one season at a time. How do you think about that longevity?
I'm so glad actually that I didn't arrive at Schiaparelli doing couture until now. You know, I think if it had happened 5 years ago, I would feel really lost. Like, I think timing was perfect here. But I don't know. A lot of it is, especially now, because my industry is really going through a renaissance in a lot of ways, that it feels season by season. But I also don't think that this role is sustainable the way it is right now for a long, 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 long term. I think that there's got to be a better way of either being a creative director or being at the top of your game in fashion without pulling these kind of hours for such an extended period of time. I don't know, like I'm still figuring that out. And I do long for the things that what I haven't understood yet is why the things that nourish me as a person are not really available to me right now. And what does that mean going forward? Is this a temporary thing? And eventually I'll be bi-coastal and it won't make a big deal. It won't be a big deal, but I don't know. I'm still very much processing that and kind of figuring out what my non-negotiables are.
Daniel and I had to any listeners who like feel far away from your friends or your community at times, whether work pulls you away or whatever that is, we have this saying, which is crocodile feeding or snake feeding. And if you know anything about crocodiles, which I know learned everything I know from David Attenborough, they eat, especially the adults, eat maybe twice a year, every 6 months. And then they just like sit in the soup and do whatever they're doing the rest of the year. And so the joke is when Daniel comes to visit us, he's crocodile feeding. He's getting, and we go big. We have campfires. We go camping. We go on drives. We have whole evenings, dinners, all the things, and fill him up with joy and deep conversations until his head's going to blow up. And then we send him off to go make some nipple jewelry.
And bask in the glow of my chosen family. I mean, it's really, I came back so on cloud nine after the last trip, so it was really special.
Okay, next question. Okay, maybe think about your time at Thom Browne, maybe before that. I don't know the timeline of your life, but when you do feel like you might have a calling, a dream, a purpose, you're good at something, and it's not hitting, or you don't know how to take it to the next level, what advice would you give to someone to be like, how do I know when to pivot my ship? Like, how do I know when to give up? I've been trying to start this company for 9 years and I just can't. I've been trying to make baskets and sell them on Etsy and no one gives a flying flickety flick buck fuck and I don't know what to do. and maybe I should stop even though I love it. Like, mm-hmm. what? How do you know to keep going versus listen to the signs of the universe saying, maybe you shouldn't do this?
Right. Well, I mean, that question really resonates with me because I spent 10 years at Thom Browne, and they were some of those years where I was really wrestling with what I was supposed to do next. And I ended up leaving Thom Browne with nothing lined up. So I really stepped into the void as a 33-year-old young adult with sleeping on my friend's apartment in Soho and doing nothing, literally had no prospects. And what I did, and I, you know, just to get really concrete here, because I'm a very triple Virgo, like very earthy, it really helps for me just to say a few things, because I adopted a few practices. One is that I did this book that's from the 70s. It's called The Artist's Way. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
Oh, yes. I've heard of it. I haven't done it, but I've heard of it.
Julie Cameron. And there is it's an iconic book that is meant to reconnect creatives with their inner child and discover like their core desires, basically. But, and it's an amazing journey that you go through. And I did it before I left Thom Browne. It helped me process the leaving. But one of the things that really changed my life, and I did it a few days ago, is the morning pages. And that's when you wake up every morning for a certain period of time and you write longhand 3 pages before you do anything, before you get on your phone, before you can make a coffee, but you just write 3 pages longhand. And it can be anything. It can be, I don't want to do this today. This is stupid, blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't, you just don't stop writing. And it, over the course of a few weeks, my mind was blown in what happened. And all these, you know, very clarifying desires and resolutions started coming to me. Wow. And you're also not supposed to reread your pages. You put
Ever?
Them away. You can later, but not, you know, maybe like a year later, you can come back to them. So that was one thing that I think was really like helped dislodge me. The other thing was I made a list. It's so stupid, but I'm a list maker. And I made a list of, on a big, big piece of drawing paper, I made a list of all the people that I knew and made up fantasy, like all the different solutions or all the different avenues I could go. I could go design, learn how to design furniture with this person. I could move to LA, you know, sleep on Jed's couch and blah, 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 intern for this person. And it just made a real, it was like a heart opener, brain opener exercise that really felt, and what I ended up doing was not on the list. I would never have anticipated something like this, but it was extremely motivating and encouraging. And, you know, I think a lot of it is just giving yourself space to listen. And I think, like we were saying before, removing this pressure and the urgency to be Mozart or to be, you know, any of that stuff for me is like the antithesis of, you know, it's like trying to be funny. It's like, it's not going to happen like that. So, but I'm really, how would you answer that question?
Well, the thing that I always think about is what do you love and what loves you back? And I feel like if you are good at something, well, if you are good at something, people will notice. Mm-hmm. Even if you're just medium good.
Right.
And so if you're making things, Seth Godin said this thing that I always think about, which is if you make something, if you write an essay, let's say, mm-hmm. and you send it to your friends, mm-hmm. if your friends read it and say, oh, that was great. Great job, Jed. And then they don't send it to anyone else, then that is proof that they're just being nice friends.
Yeah.
You know that you are onto something. If someone that you don't know says, I got this from a friend that got it from a friend that got it from your friend, all of a sudden, the thing that you made is living on its own. That is something that you can make money from or have a career from, because you can make something that doesn't need the complex quilt of your personality, your relationships, your history. You went to high school, that's your cousin. That is removed. The thing lives on its own. And so when you're starting a restaurant, when you're trying to do anything, the thing must be able to live on its own. And I don't know. And that's when it loves you back. If you create something and then that thing loves you back by walking on its own.
Totally.
That, to me, that's the clue. And if it's not walking yet, that's the universe saying you're probably, you have a desire and a curiosity for something, but you just haven't quite figured it out yet. So go get that big piece of paper, make Daniel's thing, and imagine the feeling that you're trying to feel and try, do a bunch of arrows and see different avenues. And maybe one of those will click better.
I think it's important too that, you know, you learn so much from, you know, your gifts or whatever your passions are, the way that they're interacting with the world around you and with the people who love you, you know. And I think that for people who don't know what they want to do, for me, I'm a processor verbally, like, and talking to the people who are in my life, who have been put in my life, and talking through those things with them and seeing, you know, I'm sure like that there are things that they would share that would also be clarifying too. You know, I think we put so much pressure on ourselves to figure it out on our own, and it takes a village, you know. And I think a lot of this is about onboarding people onto who you are, getting people to believe in you, bringing people onto your vision, and being able to do that and ask for help. I think that's like the biggest, did you like Brandi Carlile? She just said in that Brené Brown podcast, she said, people come up to me and say, you know, Brandi, it's so amazing what's happened with you. You got everything you always wanted. She goes, I didn't get everything I always wanted. I got everything I've asked for. You have to be asking people, the people in your life for help. You have to be able to bring them on to your vision, basically.
That's so challenging to me because I'm so independent, even though like I like to like think I do things on my own and maybe I ask for help here and there. I mean, I'm very community based, but that's a really challenging word that I'm going to think about. Okay.
That's good, right?
It's yeah, good. That's really yeah. good.
Yeah.
How do you, because you work in a industry that is made or broken by both people wanting it and critics responding to it, magazines responding to it. What the write-up says is major. And in a way that if I sell a Beta cup, that whatever, a Yelp review, I don't even know, an Amazon review, who cares? But like, I don't know. How do you wrap your head around and how do you perceive and digest reviews? What do you think about them?
I mean, when I first got the job, and I was going into the first collection, the first season, and we were on the eve of the first show. And Hanya, who we were talking about earlier, said, you know, Daniel, just do me a favor. Do not read the reviews. She was like, the good ones are never good enough and the bad ones will stick with you forever. And I read all of the reviews. I think like... I find it, for me, it's incredibly motivating to read, to know and to understand what people are getting and what people are, what's not there yet, you know. And there are creatives who, if they get, like Tom was like this, if there was a bad review, he'd be like, that's their problem. If we get a bad review, or if I get a bad review, I seriously grapple with it to know, is this something that I'm not successfully communicating yet? Or does this person just have a stick up their ass and they're not on board with me? Because there's that too. You just can't win them all.
And do you feel like you can tell the difference? You can tell an intelligent, well-reasoned critique versus somebody who's just butthurt for this reason or that?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I even if I can't tell, I can decide who I will take it to, who I will take seriously or not. But my favorite review, which will stick with me forever, was was a good review. It wasn't great. It was my hero, Tim Blanks. He's like the most, I told you this in LA, he's the most iconic kind of fashion critic out there. And he said, you know, a fashion orgasm at Schiaparelli, it wasn't perfect, but it was brave. And I've always been that for 2 years, that's been ringing in my ears, being like, if I'm going to take a little bit of a hit on perfection in order to take a big swing and to like blow my load in front of everybody, like I'm going to do that for sure. So it's also, I was saying, if I could wish to be one thing, I wish I was funnier. I wish I was more funny. I wish I could tell a joke better. But I am constantly trying to have more of a sense of humor about criticism also, because at the end of the day, like it could crush you. But I try and sidestep that.
I remember reading reviews accidentally of To Shake the Sleeping Self, and this one woman was like, I did not expect all this Jesus mumbo jumbo. I love cycling. And I was like, I remember, because it was like one star, and I was like, oh my God, I wasn't ready for this. And but I clicked on it. And then as I'm reading her review, I'm thinking, oh yeah, like I read 100 Years of Solitude, Nobel Prize winning book, and hated it. Like, what does anybody know? And this, she didn't want to read this book about Jesus and being gay on a bicycle, but I wanted to write it. And I have thousands of emails of people who are like weeping into the keyboard that it changed their life. So it's not for everyone. And if you can really learn to differentiate that, it's profound in seeking the truth, because sometimes someone might say, you know, Jed has a privileged blind spot and it's blah, blah, blah. And they might have some really constructive thing to say that, you know, I'm not saying everybody should go out there and read all the reviews. I'm just saying there is a perspective where if you can manage the ego, you can learn. What is the, and we can edit this out if you don't want to say it, but I literally think about it every day, which is the technique about framing yourself when you were at Tom Brown and where you imagined a review.
Framing myself. What do you mean?
Where you wrote the review you wanted and then moved towards it.
So there was a season at Tom Brown where we had just dressed the first lady for the Obama's second inauguration. And that happened in January, right? And then in February, we had the women's collection, which was sort of in line with the silhouette that we made for her. And I still remember the review. It was a New York Times review about that collection. And it said, Tom Brown makes a bid to become one of the great women's wear designers of the 20th century the 21st century. It was one of those like what we were talking about with your book, like an unforgettable day. It's just an unforgettable debut. It's one of those phrases that you just can't unhear. And I was so tickled by the review and motivated by the review that I set out to write a review of the collection that we had just started. So 4 months before the runway, I wrote a sort of phantom review, and we worked towards that. And I've done that since. I'm not every season, but I find it's kind of like the morning pages. I find it extremely, it's groundbreaking, actually, when you sit down and you start thinking about what is it. It's a way of setting an intention. That's all it is. But I personally get so activated and turned on by the format of reviews that it's a really fun exercise for me. If you hate reviews and you hate criticism, I don't think it's going to work. But that's something that I've never really talked about on the record before. But I think it's a really cool exercise. And I wish I had started that earlier.
The moment you told me that, I cannot stop thinking about it or talking about it, because it ties into the idea of intention rules your life, and to the morning pages, figuring out the words and the way to think about something. For me, like I'm about to start on my third book, and I've got this idea, I've got this pitch, it's my publishers are reviewing it now. And if they say yes, which I think they will, I'm so excited to take that advice and imagine how I want the reader to feel. Imagine how I want them to describe the way that this journey made them feel and then move towards that feeling.
Exactly.
Like that is so,
exactly.
And anything, whether it's designing a Beta coffee mug, this is, I remember I designed it this way without knowing I was doing your technique of write the review you want and move towards it. I was like, what's the coffee mug I want? I drink coffee every day and I cannot find the one that I want. What would it look like? Okay, it would taper here to fit and everything. It would fit in a small hand and a big hand. It'd be beautiful. It would come in cool color. Like I somehow knew what it was and then I went out and made it.
It's really, yeah, you're designing it. And I think you could even apply it to conflict. Like if you have a conflict with a family member or with a friend, sometimes for me, it's like, what if instead of talking about it with your friends, thinking about it on your own, you anticipated, where do I want to be with this person in 5 years?
Whoa.
Do I want this to have affected us? And do I want our relationship to have taken a hit on, like a significant hit because of this? And if not, what are the things that I need to do to make this work? Or, you know, I think writing it down, there's nothing like it. It's really, there's magical powers on the page. And that's what she says in The Artist's Way. She just says, put it on the page.
Wow. I really think that's going to be impactful for a lot of people and me specifically. So thank you for going on the record. Okay, one more question and then I want to play a listener question. So this is the age-old question for creatives who have actually made their creativity a job. How do you balance what you want to do with what you think will sell?
I try and make them the same thing. So for me, McQueen, for example, he said, you know, I don't go to therapy. I do my shows instead of therapy. You know, there was a very emotional working it out kind of that was happening in his work. It's not like that for me. I like playing the game of fashion. I love everything about it. I like activating people's imagination. I like designing things that all my friends want to have. Like I'm about to send you guys a bunch of jewels. For me, mass consumers, it's different. Like what I'm doing is not for the masses. If I was working at J. Crew, this would be a different conversation. But normally, for me, it's really about finding the sweet spot that takes time between something that works for the people and also is fulfilling for myself. And, you know, you could talk to other people, like if you ask Hanya that, or if you ask Tom Brown that, they'd be like, I don't care. Like there are people who wake up in the morning, they step outside and say, this is my vision. Everybody get on board or don't. But I'm not going to waste any energy trying to win your approval. And I have so much respect for that. I was mentored by that. But I personally like connecting with people. I like activating the imagination and I don't know. I don't see those things at odds with my creative vision at all. Like I like that they complement each other. Does that make sense?
I mean, I feel so kindred to your answer because as a writer, if I'm going to write my pages and get it on the page of what I'm actually trying to do is make people's lives make more sense, make people love being alive more, make people feel more comfortable in their own skin. And if I'm writing in such an esoteric, strange, poetic way that it hits people in the face and they're like, what the hell? I don't even know what he's talking about.
Yeah,
I don't write for just myself. I do. But for me, the electricity, the joy is when I can do the work to make my thoughts float into your brain and they click in your brain as if they were your thoughts. That's the work. And that's what I love. And so that's why the trying to make a book that's readable, trying to write in a way that people can understand is exactly what I'm trying to do.
Completely. Yeah. It's for me, the idea of like an artist who's not really known during their lifetime or who's really just, I love that. I do.
It is very romantic in a way.
It is so romantic. It's so beautiful and it's so poetic. But when I think about, I think Beyonce at Coachella, it is the, that seamless alignment between a pure artistic vision and a mass response that just says yes. And I think that that is such a bright star to kind of be going towards. And that's more motivating for me. And I think for you too.
Right. Okay, I have, yeah, absolutely. Okay. I have a very tender listener question that I think a lot of people either feel now or have felt. And I'm curious as to your answer. Here it comes.
Hello, my name is Lily. And my question is about work. I'm about to finish my degree and I got a job related to it. And sometimes I don't have any idea of how to do what they ask me to do. And honestly, that frustrates me because I think, well, I've been studying about this like 4 years and I don't know how to do it. And yeah, that frustrates me. I feel, I don't know, desperate. And I don't know if this is what I should do or not. I'm a little bit lost and I really want to know if this means that I need to look for another option.
I love Lily.
It's such a sweet voice. I could listen to that. I wish that question was longer. I don't know. I've definitely felt like that. I mean, I often still feel like that. And I think it's a good sign. I think that I think that when you are doing something that kind of scares you a little bit, that's a good sign that you're moving in the right direction. And everyone feels like that at the beginning of a job or at the beginning of their careers. It's vital that you feel like that. It's also vital that you, for me, the two most important things are having a world-class attitude, like an amazingly beautiful, positive attitude, so that you just kind of glow in the dark when you're in your office space or wherever you're working. And then the other is to just ask for help. One of my pet peeves is people who don't know what they don't know or won't admit what they don't know. And I think that if you are able to do those things, and people love helping other people too. People love knowing what to do when the other person doesn't. So for me, it's about, yeah, staying positive and asking for help.
I love that answer. I've learned so much from Seth Godin, and he gave this example that when you're at a job, there are three things and you only need to do two. Turn your work in on time, the work is good, and people like you. You only need two.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if people like you and the work is good, it can be late. They love you.
Totally.
If they like you and it's on time, but it's not that great, they still love you. It's fine. They'll make it. It's like, but if it's so fun, it's just, if it's really good work and it's on time, but you're annoying, well, it's really good work. So they're going to deal with it.
That's good. I'll remember that for sure.
But I think world-class attitude is actually almost the most important, because if you're going to spend every waking hour with somebody and you're just like suck the air out of a room, either you're a genius with your hands at the purse, or people hate you. And that energy, I just can't imagine living my life like that. And just the belief that, yeah, nobody knows what they're doing. It's incredible what asking for help, and just the thing is, there was something about you that got you hired. You didn't walk in there and not know anything. Like, they hired you knowing that they know what your education is,
right?
And they're pushing you. They're seeing what you can do.
Right.
And I don't think you'll be hard pressed to find anyone that's good at anything who just started it knowing what they were doing. That's the whole point.
Totally. And there's always grace for, unless you are, I mean, in, unless you are the boss or something, there's always grace for making mistakes and learning. I mean, that's part of the job. I think if it feels like something that's against who you are or what you really want to do, that goes back to the first part of our conversation. It's like, you have to know what inspires you. You have to know, find out what your purpose is, you know? And
that's a really good wrinkle, because you might have thought you wanted to be a movie director and then you got there and tried it. I mean, hopefully, like, that film school at USC actually did the opposite of, Lily, your question. Film school actually showed me what it was like, because we were making films and I was like, oh no, I hate this.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe your education didn't prepare you properly, but I think what it may really be is just the complexities of reality. It's like, it's really complex to do any job, and surprising things come up.
Right.
And your ability to pivot and try things with a smile and make a team like excited that you're there, it will get you really far, and you sound like a great person.
Okay, that's all for episode one. I think you should binge it. It's a Netflix moment. Let's just go and jump into episode two, but you can also listen to episode two a little later. Up to you. Okay, see you soon.